This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. He ran against the Chicago Machine on a pledge of reforming Illinois politics. He took his populist campaign on the road, walking the length of the state. And he won, defeating Paul Simon in the Democratic primary and incumbent Richard Ogilvie in the general election. Dan Walker served one contentious term as governor from 1973 to 1977. In 76, he lost the primary to Mike Howlett, and Howlett lost the general election to Jim Thompson. Walker returned to the private sector. In the 1980s, he ran into trouble as chairman and CEO of a savings and loan association. He would plead guilty to federal charges of bank fraud, misapplication of bank funds, and perjury. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison, to be followed by 5 years of probation. He was released in 1989 after serving a year and a half. Prior to becoming governor of Illinois, Walker was a naval officer in World War II and the Korean War. A graduate of Northwestern University School of Law, he clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Fred Vinson. He worked in Chicago as a trial lawyer and business executive. Dan Walker tells his story in the memoir, The Maverick in the Machine, and he is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Governor Walker, welcome. How are you?
I am doing just fine for an old man, Celeste. And lots of get up and go, and just so happy to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. In the introduction to this book, this memoir, you note Illinois' infamous reputation as being what someone called a petri dish for corruption. Why is Illinois political culture so often tainted by scandal?
Let me answer that directly, but first, one minor correction, Celeste, forgive me. I was not charged with or convicted of any misapplication of funds. I never personally benefited in terms of money from that S&L other than the salaries and expense accounts, which were normal. But anyway, let me answer your question.
Well, let me ask you for your forgiveness then. My apologies for being
incorrect. That's all right. That's all right. I just don't like people have the idea that I made a lot of money or something, because I sure didn't. Anyway, let me answer your question directly. The Chicago Tribune has said that Chicago is the most corrupt city in the United States, perhaps. And certainly events have borne that out. Over 130 indictments, felony indictments, in Chicago and also in state government, including those in this last year or two. That's an astounding number. And the basic reason is the rotten pay-to-play system that dominates the political situation in Illinois. It's bipartisan. It's not just one party. That is, it's a total operation of state and city government. Springfield and Chicago is through and through pay-to-play. Money, money, money.
Mm. What are your thoughts on the charges, trial, and conviction of George Ryan?
Well, there were numerous charges. The one that stood out to me was one that said that he furnished his political campaign with lots of money by having state employees go out and raise political contributions for him. And he did that as Secretary of State and as governor. Testimony at the trial said that most of his campaign funds were raised by state employees. Well, I prohibited that practice by executive order when I was governor, that and other similar practices. First time it had ever been done, and no governor after me ever had the guts to repeat those executive orders, and certainly Ryan did not. And I don't believe that government employees should be used. Well, look at Mr. Blagojevich, the incumbent governor. He's a Democrat, and I'm a Democrat. But he raised, I think the figure I saw in the media was $19 million for his campaign. Is somebody going to tell me that no state employees had nothing to do with that? I don't believe it. That certainly is not the information I've received from friends and associates. And number two, why did all those people give $19 million? I don't care for that kind of politics and that kind of government.
Now, when you read news stories about the investigations into the current administration and the current Daley administration, what do you think?
Well, I think it's rotten. I think it's just plain rotten. And I see very few voices being raised to put an end to it. Sure, people say that they don't do it, and I don't personally think that Mayor Daley, for example, goes out there and pockets money. I don't believe that, but certainly his cronies do, and certainly people around him do, and certainly he and others condone it. And the condoning of these practices is what it's all about. We've got to get state government, and even in the city of Chicago, city government employees out of the business of finding the money for political campaigns.
What would that take?
Well, in my case, I did it by executive order. I could not get a statute through the legislature, so I did it by executive order. The mayor could do that. Governor Blagojevich could do that, but he hasn't.
We have someone waiting on the telephone to talk with you, so let's go and take this listener call. A listener from Vandalia, line 4. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. I'm way down south here, so I'm going to make it quick before I lose the
signal. The old state capital.
Yes, exactly right. One quick, very quick aside, and then a quick question. Governor, my mother hosted a luncheon for your wife in 1972 on the south side of Chicago with some of her lady friends, and that was one of my first experiences into the political system, as it were. So, but the Chicago Tribune a few weeks ago did a review of your book, and the gentleman who did the review, I don't know his name, I don't remember it, but he said he thought that you would be a very good dentist or a very good engineer or a very good lawyer, but he thought that you should have never thought about running for governor. He didn't think it was a good fit, and I was just wondering for your comments if you thought that was a fair assessment. And if everything that you know now, rethinking it, would you still consider running for governor when you did? And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Direct answers, number one, thanks to your mother very, very much. Number two, yes, I would do it again. Number three, I did it by executive order. That reviewer that you referred to, I read that review. It was just a personal attack on me. I don't believe the man who wrote that review ever read my book, Maverick and the Machine, because he said nothing about one of the major themes of that book, which is the use of the executive order to stop the scams and the bad things that are being done in state government. Didn't even refer to it in the review. I didn't pay much attention to the review. I've read some others that did pay more attention to what's in the book. He never mentioned, for example, anything about the efforts that I made to change the whole budgeting practice in the state of Illinois. But anyway, I could go on and on. If you've got the impression I didn't think much of that review, you're certainly right.
What were your relationships like with the legislature during your tenure as governor?
Well, it was contentious, particularly at the beginning. My disagreements were, number one, with the Chicago legislators, the Daley legislators, and the Republicans, because they joined together to torpedo my initial cabinet selections. Never been done to a governor before the way they did it. And these were well-qualified people that they tubed, to use the old political expression. But they declared war on me at the beginning of my administration, and it was a fight. In 74, after 2 years, we got a lot of better open-minded legislators elected, and it turned around. And it was much better thereafter, but still the Daley Democrats and the Republicans were out to get me.
Your style as governor has been described as confrontational. What led you to that approach?
Well, I don't know any way to tackle a problem without confronting it. And if that's confrontational, so be it. These were difficult problems. Mr. Daley threw down the gauntlet. What am I supposed to do, roll over and play dead? He did that in the opening weeks of the first session of the General Assembly. And again, I repeat it, should I lay down and roll over for Daley, or should I fight? That were the only choices that I had. You don't compromise with that Chicago machine at all. You do it their way or the highway, as they say.
Is the contentiousness, the conflict we see between Governor Blagojevich and the legislature today at all reminiscent to you of your tenure as governor?
It's totally different. The contest here is between the gubernatorial power and the legislative power. Witness the lawsuit he has just filed, and in which he wants the court to order the General Assembly to conduct a special session when he tells them to. That kind of a lawsuit is almost unheard of. I never had that kind of a difference with the legislature. We fought over individual appropriations. Sure, every governor does. We did that. But we didn't have the kind of a head-on budget fight that is involved in the present standoff between the legislature as a whole and the governor. I didn't have that.
What do you think the chances are for that lawsuit succeeding?
Well, I'd be amazed if it were successful. I haven't researched it, but my memory of what the law is says to me, number one, courts don't usually issue what are called affirmative injunctions, that is, telling somebody to do something. Usually injunctions tell somebody not to do something. And the second thing is there's a separation of powers here. The governor can set a date for the General Assembly to meet, and he certainly can do that. But to force the legislature to meet and legislate, as I gather this lawsuit tries to do, is another kettle of fish. I don't think that's possible under the Illinois Constitution. But, as I say, I haven't researched it.
Let's talk with another listener. A caller in Eureka, Illinois. Line 1. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask two questions, and then I'll get off and take my answer off the air.
Okay.
I believe it was stated, sir, that in the program that Illinois was one of the most politically corrupt states in the country. I wonder if there are any outside credible sources that could either affirm that and or support that proposition. And secondly, how would you characterize current Governor Blagojevich, though you have made several comments, especially in light of how he would be in terms of corruption as compared to other governors? Thank you.
Number one, I did not make that statement. The Chicago Tribune, in an editorial, said that Chicago may be the most, or one of the most, I don't remember which, corrupt cities in the United States. There was not a statement with respect to the state of Illinois. It was the city of Chicago, and the statement was not mine. The statement was the Chicago Tribune's. Number two, with respect to Mr. Blagojevich, I'm not really close enough to the events there to judge it overall. I don't know the details of state finance and how much money is really available for that massive public health program that he is proposing. So I'm not in a position to judge overall. I think he's done some good things. I certainly want to see more health care, for example. But I think he's demonstrated some arrogance. And let me mention one thing. The Constitution of Illinois says that the governor shall reside in Springfield. Mr. Grigorievich refuses to live in the executive mansion. He runs the state government from an office up on the northwest side of Chicago. I've been a governor. I know what it takes to run that state government. I don't believe you can do it from an office up in Chicago. I believe the governor belongs in Springfield at the seat of state government. So I am perfectly willing to criticize him for that. As to the overall financial situation of the state, it would be ridiculous of me to try to comment without detailed knowledge, which I simply do not have.
Former Illinois Governor Dan Walker is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author most recently of a memoir, The Maverick and the Machine. Governor Walker tells his story. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. If former Governor Ryan finds his appeals exhausted and he is sent to prison, what awaits him?
Hey, I don't know what awaits him. I went to the federal prison up in Duluth, and I understand from the media that that's the prison that the Bureau of Prisons has said he will go to, although his counsel, former Governor Thompson, is arguing against that, asking that he be sent to the much more pleasant prison in Oxford, Wisconsin. Duluth is a terrible place weather-wise, right on the border up there. It's a former Air Force base, and the wind comes right from Canada, right across that tarmac. But I've heard, and everybody has read or heard, of the description of those federal minimum security prisons as country club prisons, or club fed, some columnist called them. Well, I want to say this. Anybody who reads my book, The Maverick and the Machine, will never use those phrases again. Absolutely not. What I encountered at that prison, I hope that Governor Ryan does not encounter this, was a warden who hated me, and a system of guards that was humiliating, depressing, and drove me to serious consideration of suicide.
Yeah. You describe the scene at your intake in the book. You were strip searched and left standing naked for a while before you were given your prison uniform. It was humiliating and, I suppose, designed to be so. And then a little later in the story, we have you being given a job by the warden, one of your assignments. He said to you, let's see how a governor scrubs bathroom floors and toilets. And you just mentioned that at one point you were suicidal. How did you hold it all together in the end? How did you handle the humiliations?
Let me quickly, Celeste, very quickly give a little more detail about that. The command that was delivered by the guard from time to time was squat and spread. So it wasn't just when I first went in there. And squat and spread, you can, imagination will tell you what that means. You take off all your clothes and every cavity of your body is searched by the guard using rubber gloves. It's a hugely humiliating process. And then the warden decided I had a pretty decent job the first couple of months as clerk for the chapel. And this warden decided that that was not for me, and so he put me to work cleaning toilets. The clothing store had both women and men staff members, and I cleaned the toilets, both men and women, and he also had me spearing cigarette butts with a stick that had a nail on the end of it. This is in the middle of winter, and I walked around the administration building spearing cigarette butts. But I do want to say to the ladies out there in the audience, I cleaned toilets back when I was a sailor in the Navy, an apprentice seaman, many years ago. And over, I guess, 40, 50 years, I want to say that the science of cleaning toilets has not changed.
Hmm. Writing this and being so open about your time at Duluth and in the prison there, was it difficult or was it cathartic? Why did you write this book?
I wrote it to bare my soul, actually, and to tell my family what my life really consisted of. I was afraid that my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and I have almost 30 of those, would have a warped idea of my life. And so I decided to spell it out, and so I did. And as long as I was about it, I decided to be brutally honest with it and to use the same phrase I used before, to bare my soul. I think anybody who reads that book, and many people have told me, that it's a devastatingly honest depiction. of what machine politics is like, how bad it is. It's a devastating picture of the destruction of a man, me, by that prison system, and what you go through when you confront the thought of climbing a water tower that is 60 feet high and decide you're going to step off into nothing and hope that you'll be unconscious when you hit the tarmac. Mm-hmm. And I managed to get through that. And you asked me earlier how. Well, my father taught me that one of the worst things a man can do is give in to what he called PLOM, poor little old me. And he burned that into my consciousness as a kid. And I don't believe in PLOM, and I don't believe in cowards. And so I said to myself over and over again, don't be a coward, Dan. Don't be a coward. And I fought my way out of that, and I want to say with the help of Jesus also.
Mm-hmm. Another piece of advice your father gave you was nothing halfway, nothing halfway. He was a pretty tough character. Nothing halfway, did that advice serve you well?
Yes, yes, hard work. I would put it hard work. Hard work. Hard work is very, very telling on a man's future and a woman's too, for that matter. Women know hard work, men know hard work, and the only way you get things done, the best way you get things done, I should say, is hard work. There are other routes. I did hard work all the time, and it took hard work.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about your dad's breakfast sermons, and then maybe did you tell your sons, your kids, did you have breakfast sermons for them?
I tried to. I didn't do it as rigorously and as much as my father did. And by the way, when I was in prison, I remembered those sermons, and I wrote letters to my seven children and repeated those sermons in those letters, which I believe most or all of them still have. He taught my brother and me through those sermons a lot of things, the dangers of PLOM, the dangers of alcohol, the dangers that beset a man as he goes through life. And he taught us to be decent, to be honest, to be open, and taught us the benefit of self-discipline. I think that's probably the most important lesson he taught, self-discipline. If you can't control yourself, then you don't deserve to be out there as a human being.
Hmm. What sparked your interest in politics?
Always had it, Celeste, always had it. Yeah. I don't know, from the very beginning, maybe it was my mother, my father, I don't know. My father wanted me to be a lawyer, and somehow or other I translated that into government. And from my earliest days of memory, I remember wanting to be in government, to be a lawyer, to work in government, and I kind of planned that. My father certainly nurtured that hope, and it finally came about after 10 years in the Navy. I left the Navy and went to law school and embarked on that career.
Yeah. Speaking of nothing halfway, you were an outstanding student, top of your class at Northwestern. And then you got the clerkship at the U.S. Supreme Court. What were those days like for you and your wife at the time, Roberta, and your young family?
Well, those were halcyon days because I was doing what I really loved. At the Naval Academy at Annapolis, I went there after serving as an enlisted man, a sailor, as I said earlier. And at the Academy, I didn't particularly enjoy the engineering subjects, and I didn't do too well. And then I hit law school, and oh boy, I fell in love with that. And did very, very well, as you mentioned. And my wife was very understanding, and we had children right away. I had three children by the time I graduated from law school. And my first job down in Springfield was kind of an awakening to what real life is like after law school. And then the days at the Supreme Court were wonderful. And working for the Chief Justice, of course, was a tremendous challenge. And then I got called back to active duty with the Navy and served in Korea.
Yeah. Was the 48 campaign for Paul Douglas and Adlai Stevenson, Douglas for Senate and Stevenson for governor, was that your first campaign to work going door-to-door trying to drum up votes for those two candidates?
Well, actually not, but first serious one.
First serious one.
Boy, you've really done your homework, Celeste, and I really appreciate talking to somebody who's taken the trouble to really read The Maverick and the Machine. I worked as an assistant precinct captain in Chicago as soon as I arrived in that city because I wanted to learn about machine politics. And I worked as a captain for assistant precinct captain for other candidates, but my first serious candidates, yes, were Paul Douglas and Adlai Stevenson, and I really respected and adored those men, particularly Adlai. And as you know, Celeste, later I went to work for Adlai when he ran for the presidency.
Yeah. You were also part of Adlai's reelection campaign for governor in 52, and he lost that race to Bill Stratton, Republican Bill Stratton. Why didn't Stevenson lose that race?
Well, it was just the overwhelming popularity of Ike, of General Eisenhower, overwhelming. Stevenson was widely respected, gave wonderful speeches, had a very thoughtful approach to the presidency and to our national government, and he was a great man. I learned a lot from Adlai, and I'm really sorry that he lost, but in retrospect, he didn't really have a chance. Eisenhower was just too popular, and then Adlai ran again in 56. I tried to help then, but he lost again to Eisenhower.
Who do you think have been Illinois' best governors?
Oh, goodness, leg aside myself, of course. I'm being humorous, and I was not actually one of the best governors because I had to fight so hard with Daley, or Daley fought so hard with me. By the way, Celeste, people used to ask me, reporters, why don't you accommodate Daley more? And I used to respond and say, well, why don't you ask it the other way around? Why doesn't the mayor of the city of Chicago accommodate the governor more? But anyway, I wouldn't put myself in the ranks of the best Illinois governors. I think Adlai was a very, very fine governor, certainly one of the best, if not the best.
What's your assessment of the governor you defeated, Richard Ogilvie, excuse me?
Well, Dick was a very, very conscientious guy, and I respected him for that. He fought the grand battle to give Illinois the income tax, which really hurt him a lot. People all over the state hated the income tax. Many still do. And that hurt him a lot. I never criticized him for that when I ran against him because I knew the state had to have it. You've got to raise enough money to take care of education, take care of the poor people, do the things that have to be done in the state. And we had to have the income tax to do that. So I thought Ogilvie was a decent guy. I disagreed with some of the things that he did, and I spelled those out in the campaign. I thought he spent too much money, and I criticized him heavily for spending too much money. I thought he built some wrong kinds of roads in the state, and I criticized him for that. And I thought he put up with too many scandals.
Hmm. You say as early in the Maverick and the Machine, as early as the mid-1950s, you wanted to position yourself as an...
Hello? Yes.
Okay. You say in the book, The Maverick and the Machine, that as early as the mid-1950s, you wanted to position yourself as an independent Democrat. At that point in your life, what did you imagine that to mean, precisely?
I imagined it to mean that a person was a Democrat because he believed in the issues that made the Democratic Party good, not because there was a boss that told you what to do. It was as simple as that. I wanted issue politics, and that's what I tried to bring to the Democratic Party in Illinois throughout my life before I became governor, fighting against patronage, jobs, contracts, that kind of thing, controlling our political system. I wanted issues. I wanted to educate people on issues and get people to vote on the basis of issues. I thought the Democratic Party was the party of the people because it celebrated issues that were important to people, and I still believe that.
Were you ever tempted to leave the Democratic Party?
Nope. Never have been. Never have been because of that fundamental issue right there, the one that I just said. Now, there are those who will disagree with me, and they're certainly entitled to. And there are times when I think with Joe Lieberman, for example, the senator that my party has walked away from me in many respects. I'm a very conservative Democrat, so also the current trend of the liberal portion of our party, I'm not in sympathy with. But overall, I'm still a Democrat.
Mm. You tell a great story in the book about your naivete knocking on doors in the city's first ward back in the early 1950s. And the guy you were with said, "Don't talk about the issues, Dan. Shut up." What did you think when he told you that? And what was his method? And did you at all come around on that point?
Well, I had mixed feelings. When you're dealing with campaigning, canvassing, it's called, in poor neighborhoods, you certainly understand the decency of the Democratic Party reaching out to help these people by fixing their, seeing that they got food, fixing their traffic tickets. They didn't know where to go to do anything, and so there's sympathy for that. I certainly understood that. The old women who would look me in the eye when I knocked on their door and say, they'd say, "What are you bringing me, some food, or what are you bringing me?" And when I would try to talk with them about doing something about the schools or the health care system, they just weren't much interested. And so I certainly understand how machine politics in poor neighborhoods produces things for people, but that didn't stop me from not liking that system. I want a system where you care about people and get government to take care of people, and political machines are not part of my solution.
Mm. If I'm remembering this correctly, you met Richard J. Daley for the first time when he was county clerk. He was probably more importantly at that moment chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party. Before meeting him, you say you were prepared to like him. What was your first meeting like? What were your first impressions?
Just beyond an impression, I'm glad you used that word, Celeste. My impression of him was that he was kind of like a Buddha. He just didn't say much, and it became clear that he didn't understand my way of thinking. He didn't understand independent Democrats. He didn't understand somebody who wanted to talk about issues. He wanted to talk about, at that time at least, things like patronage, jobs, pardon me. And he was inscrutable. He didn't communicate well with me, and I didn't communicate well with him. And that started in our first meeting and kept up. I think that was one of our great problems. We never learned to communicate with each other.
Yeah. Also, the things that were important to the two of you were very different.
Yeah.
You became active in the civil rights movement in Chicago. We know where Richard J. Daley was there. Then there was the 1968 Democratic Nominating Convention and the Walker Report. How did these events affect your relationship with the mayor? And maybe what we should do here is go back to the time of the Walker Report and tell folks what that was all about.
Well, that was the 1968, as you said, Democratic National Convention. There were riots, and the demonstrators were acting out, and there was a lot of confrontation between the demonstrators and the police. And the police overreacted, I thought, and in that report, I said that a minority of police actually engaged in actions that could only be called a police riot. And I named it that, and that it was. It was even worse than I depicted. I did say that the majority of the police did their job, but this minority acted very badly. Daley didn't like that, of course, and tried to persuade me to, because I went to see him and talk to him and told him what was coming, and he tried to talk me out of it, but I would have none of that. I listened to him and went ahead and wrote the report the way I saw it. That's what I've always done, and that's what I was hired to do by the President's National Commission on Violence, and that's what I did. I told it like I saw it.
At the time you decided you would run for governor, what was your relationship like with the mayor at that point?
It was cold and distant, I guess is the best way to put it. Cold and distant.
Mm.
And then when I announced for governor, I said in the announcement I was going to go all out against the evils of machine politics. And, of course, that made it even colder and even more distant.
Hmm. Where did the idea come from to walk the state?
Well, good question, Celeste. We kicked it around, my staff and I. I was nowhere, going nowhere. Nobody knew who I was. Sure, I had some publicity, but most of the people in the state never heard of me. We needed something. We talked about canoeing the rivers of the state. We talked about all kinds of things to get the public's attention. And then we finally settled on the walk. A friend of mine, Lawton Childs, had run for the Senate down in Florida and had used that technique, and I talked to him about it, and we got persuaded that that was a way to do it. But my press secretary said to me at the time, very wise statement, he said, you realize, Dan, that you'll only be walking if the media says you're walking. If they put this down as a campaign gimmick and largely ignore it, then you're wasting your time, but you're going to have to go ahead and do it. So it was risky, very risky, but we went ahead and did it.
Mm. And you did it with a, if I'm recalling correctly, a denim shirt and a bandana.
That's right, a blue denim shirt and khaki trousers and a bandana and boots and two of my sons with me for most of the walk. 1,197 miles and 4 months of walking, staying almost every night with a different family. It was a grand experience. I met lots of people. And Celeste, I want to report, as people know, that I learned my state. I learned it step by step from the bottom of the state to the top of the state. And that knowledge stayed with me. And I fell in love with downstate Illinois. Yes, I did. My campaign manager used to say to me, Dan, you've got to stop spending so much money, so much time downstate. You've got to spend more time up here in Chicago. And I said, Vic, I like downstate. I like the folks down here. They're my kind of people.
Mm. So from early July through October of 71, you were on the road. How did the media treat your walking the state?
Well, we were very nervous about it at the beginning, wondering whether we would be noticed. I started out down in Brookport on the Ohio River, right across from Paducah, Kentucky. And I was pleasantly surprised, my boys and I, when a television station showed up after a few days from Chicago. And we were on the news, the nightly news, and that was the beginning. And when the Tribune and the Sun-Times from Chicago sent reporters down, that said to the media world that this was serious. And so it was taken serious. But what really got me to realize it was being taken seriously was the first time a guy came by in one of those big rigs, the big wheelers that carry the goods across the state. And that truck driver leaned out the window and shook his fist at me as he came by and yelled, keep on fighting, Dan. Give them hell, Dan. Give them hell.
Let's take another call. Listener in Batavia, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. You know what? I like this guy, the way he's talking. He sounds like a true to form human being, a honest politician. Too bad there's not a lot of those around anymore. I was wondering, how do you feel about the state of politics right now? I have a mayor that in my town is going to be running for Dennis Hastert's office, Mayor Kevin Burns. I live in Geneva, and they're basically going to be running in Kevin for Dennis Hastert's office. But I'm looking at it like, unless you're a true Republican or a Democrat or somebody that's been around for a while, you're not going to get noticed. And I think it's a shame because I feel personally that we need a third party in here. I hear it from so many folks out there that, you know, neither side does it for them anymore. We need somebody to bring these two parties together to work again, because no matter what you do, whether it be in state or national, it just seems like nothing. You're going around in circles. And I was wondering what your comments might be on this.
Good thoughts. By the way, hello, Batavia. I have wonderful memories of the Fox River and that part of the state. Yes, a beautiful town, Batavia. I have mixed feelings about what you said. Today there is a lot of fighting, but there has always been partisan fighting in the history of the United States. And quite often the divisions between the parties, think back to the Civil War, when the Democratic Party was wanted to make peace with the South and let slavery continue, and the Republican Party was dead set against that. There was a lot of divisiveness then, and thank goodness there was. Sometimes I believe that we need two parties and that kind of fighting in order to make the United States work in our peculiarly kind of constitutional system. At other times, I confess, like this guy, I wonder, maybe we should have an independent come along. Maybe we should have an independent candidacy to shake the whole system up. I do believe the system needs to be shaken up, and I hope that you, sir, will do your best to shake it up out there. I tried to shake it up in my way. Maybe now is a different way or a different time to shake it up. But shake it up, it really needs to be done.
Mm. What led to the fall in private life? What led to the problems with the SNL that ultimately sent you to prison?
I don't know the answer to that, Celeste. Some say that I was arrogant. Maybe I was. It's a difficult transition from being governor of a state with 11 million people at that time and into private life, so maybe I was somewhat arrogant. And I certainly did not do the job that I should have with the regulators of that Savings and Loan Association. And it may be that I was having I was enjoying life then. We were making good money. We had a chain of oil change centers, BW 10-minute oil change centers, plus the SNL. And we lived a good life, and I have no apologies for that. I earned that money, I worked for that money, and I spent that money. I spent too damn much of it, but anyway, I got into trouble financially. But I enjoyed that life, and I had not had that opportunity before, and it may be that I rode too high. And if you'll read the book, The Maverick and the Machine, you'll find in there a very honest account of what happened to me during those years.
Mm. Let's take one more call before we run out of time here. Listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
I'd like to know exactly what it is that makes you support Joe Lieberman. Thank you.
Okay.
I like Joe Lieberman. I didn't say I support him. I do support him because he's a good Democrat, but I like Joe Lieberman because I think he speaks his mind. I disagree with him on some issues, of course, and I gather from your question that you probably do too. But I think overall he's an independent Democrat, and he's also a conservative Democrat, and I happen to be both of those things. I like, sum it all up, I like Joe Lieberman's independence.
Mm. Is there anybody you are supporting for the Democratic nomination?
No. I'm glad to see Barack Obama out there. He offers a chance to bring some luster back to the land of Lincoln, and so I hope he succeeds. He's got a tough, tough battle to do it. But I like Hillary too, I haven't chosen up sides, and I'll be watching the campaign very closely. And I'm writing a column for a newspaper on the presidential campaigns and having a ball doing it.
Okay. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Dan Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste, and thank everybody out there. I owe so much to the people of Illinois, and particularly to the people of downstate Illinois, who always seems to get kicked around too much, in my opinion, by that machine up there in Chicago.
Dan Walker has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Dan Walker's memoir, The Maverick and the Machine, Governor Dan Walker Tells His Story, is published by Southern Illinois University Press.